hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
And I am Amanda Indica. You guys, this podcast is another, it's a great one. Riz Ahmed.
It's one for the books.
It is one for the books. So we have, for this podcast, we have the Emmy-winning actor. Yeah, Riz Ahmed. He's starring in this new movie called The Sound of Metal. It's on Amazon. I think by the time this recording is out, it's going to be ready.
It's already dropped. Yeah.
He plays a musician, a drummer, who starts experiencing a really drastic hearing loss. And then he has to sort of, you know, navigate through that, this new world that he's now in. But obviously you've seen Riz. He's been in, you know, he was in Venom, The Night
so
of.
So many things.
Your favorite Star Wars movie.
Rogue One.
Yeah.
Venom.
Yeah.
Girls.
He's been a lot, and he's done a lot. I mean, for South Asian representation. I mean, he's
just so thoughtful and
very thoughtful.
You know, I'll be honest. He's on another level.
He's giving us different ways of thinking about things, and it was just so interesting, especially when it came to, like, you know, growing up being a first generation. Even the way he approaches his roles. It's a very different way of thinking, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't want to say, like, oh my God, he sounds so smart, because that's not, insinuates that he wasn't smart to begin with. No, but it's just that his, like, the thoughtfulness and what he's, I think it also comes from the fact that he is a poet and he's a rapper.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's the epitome of what an artist is. And he's not pompous about it at all. He's just, and he was wearing a dope jacket.
His album, if you guys haven't seen it, you need to check out this video on YouTube. It's called The Long Goodbye. It's from his album that he released earlier this year.
In March?
We were both like, this is amazing. The lyrics were, it just really spoke to you. And he talks about it too, the way he sort of approached his music. And like I said, it's a different way of thinking. And he just offers this really new, fresh perspective. Hearing that, you know?
And it's also inspiring in the way he presented it. It's like, oh, he made me want to do more, you know? and it's just so amazing. In Sound of Metal, he had to go into the world of drumming in a punk rock band and being deaf. Talking about navigating those two worlds simultaneously, it's so interesting. And this movie, it's out on Amazon already, and it deserves a watch.
He's getting a lot of Oscar buzz, so I really encourage everybody to check it out. So without further ado, here is Riz. Riz, thank you so much for joining us today and for being on the New Hollywood Podcast.
I'm excited to be here. I listen to the podcast, and I'm excited to have a chat with you guys.
Yay.
Yeah. I think right before this, Amanda sent me the link to the video for The Long Goodbye.
We'll get into that.
And I watched that right before I got on. So I was just like, oh shit. That was heavy.
We were both like, this definitely speak. We're both from immigrant families. And we're like, this is amazing. This is every immigrant's experience through this song. Yeah. We can get into that later. But first I want to ask you, like, how are you doing? What have you been up to?
I'm doing good, man. I'm feeling grateful. It was my birthday yesterday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy 21st birthday.
Yeah, thank you, man. Crazy. I'm an adult.
What sign is this month?
Sagittarius.
I'm
speaking to Sagittarius. Sagittarii. I just wrapped on a shoot out here, so I'm grateful to be working. Amazing. And also just feeling a lot of gratitude just for, it's been such a tough year. It's been a lot of, you know, a lot of suffering, and there was some, we had some losses in my own family, but also just feeling grateful to, that in a weird way, this is madness of this year has brought us closer to each other, I feel like. Nobody brought us closer to ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, what really matters to us has been clarified. You know, I think of that, you know, like Buddhist monks have that saying where it's like, live with death by your side. Mm-hmm. And I think that can sound kind of morbid, but in a way, we've all had this kind of, we're living with mortality right on our shoulder right now. And so I feel like it's been very clarifying, at least for me personally.
Definitely. This has definitely been, I think, a life-changing year for a lot of people, you know. And hopefully, you know, next year we can take all the bad or the, you know, that we've taken in this year and
learn from it.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully we can learn from it. But so we, on the Deadlines in Hollywood podcast, we love to hear stories from people who come up, especially people who, you know, don't come from families that typically encourage the arts. I know a lot of first generation families that are immigrants. Like my family is from Nigeria. We never really talked about arts and entertainment in this house. It was a no-no. So for you, where did you sort of find your passion for performing? Because I mean, you don't just act, but you also you do music too.
Isn't it interesting actually when we talk about that, because you're right in that often when you're a child of immigrants, you know, the mission is to kind of get on stable footing, get on stable ground,
build,
right? And if there's anything that this game is not, it is stable, you know? Mm. And if there's anything that it is not, is actually often is not meritocratic, you know? Right. Not many industries, it can be very nepotistic. And if you don't have a foot in the door, it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
So I sympathize with that. And my parents were as anxious as any sane set of parents in their situation would be. But they were also very supportive. And they were also, and they've always been very proud and very supportive. But it's interesting when we talk about that, because on the one hand, we think of our backgrounds, you know, perhaps third culture kids or whatever, minority backgrounds, as not encouraging the arts. But if you actually look at what the daily life and existence is like in those households, it is filled with music and
culture,
film and song and dance. And the one thing that we often have in the global South, if we don't have kind of economic self-reliance, if that was taken from us through colonialism, what we still have is our culture. And our cultures are ancient, rich, unique, and world-beating. So it's almost like the one thing that we have that no one can take away from us is also the one thing that you're told not to rely on, which that kind of doesn't make sense. You're gonna fall.
I've never even thought
of it. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah, it's a tremendous, you know, and in many ways, actually, I think, you know, the African American experience has been it's a tremendous blueprint for minority cultures around the world who are looking for a roadmap to dignity and a map that no one else can kind of continue. You know, is your self-expression, your song, your dance, that can provide a home when you feel that culturally you belong. You can't bring your full self in one nation or country or city. The place where you can bring your full self, your home, becomes the culture that you can create.
Right.
So in a way, yes, it may not have been explicitly encouraged, hey, go become an actor, go become a musician. Day in, day out, what you're soaking up are, you know, songs and spirituality and the performance of ritual and, you know, Bollywood, just as there is Nollywood and all this kind of stuff. And so it's in your bones, even though if it may not be written down and given to you on a piece of paper.
Right. And we were just, we were just mentioning this, but we Dino and I, we watched your The Long Goodbye video right before we spoke to you. And we're both like, this is such a powerful and telling video. And like I said, I know you were focusing on, you know, identity, London identity, but this is something that I feel like anybody that comes from an immigrant background and also with this notion of being a foreigner in a place that you actually helped build. I think anybody that, like I said, that comes from, I guess, minority, if you want to call it that, background, really, really can relate to that sort of notion and that idea. Where did you find your voice and, like you said, your self-expression, and sort of where did you, what was the impetus to you becoming a performer and using your platform to talk about these really, really important social topics?
You know, it's that's a huge question. I feel like I want to get into a therapy session if I
speak. Yeah, right.
Oh, we're just starting. We're gonna get deeper in a minute.
I guess I'll start with the long goodbye, and I'll say that's a kind of maybe a good example of something to talk about that can maybe answer a lot of the different points in your question. So the long goodbye, you know, so I make music as a spoken word artist and a rapper, and you know, I try and kind of tie together, you know, we were talking about sometimes if you feel like you don't belong anywhere, you need to create a place of belonging. And for me, my work has always been a mission to cultivate the no man's land that people like us occupy, mm-hmm. and cultivate and turn it into a home. And so what I try and do is take, you know, UK grime, drum and bass, you know, those London music genres, and also hip hop that I grew up on, and marry that with Bollywood, Bhangra, Sufi devotional music like Qawwali. And so I've been making music like that for a minute. And the Long Goodbye album is, on one sense, you know, to touch another point in your question, it is me talking about social or political topics. But the thing is, that's not how I get into it. I'm just talking about my personal experience. And what I find is interesting is often, you know, I don't know, Taylor Swift or whoever, Miley Cyrus might talk about their personal day-to-day experience, but it may not be seen as explicitly political because it's a familiar experience. But if I talk about my daily experience and it happens to take in the fact that I got stopped in the airport again today, or on the news headlines, my nephew's watching and saying, you know, Mama, does that mean we're terrorists or whatever? That is also, that's my daily personal experience. And as an artist, that's all I'm talking about. And it's just so funny that gets deemed to be a political song or a political movie, when actually it's political in the sense that it's not, it's not, you know, the same old story. You know, maybe that's subversive in itself, but it's really me as an artist, just like any other artist, just talking about my personal day-to-day experience and reflecting my reality back to the world. And so the Long Goodbye album is basically a breakup album. Mm. It's an album about feeling like the country that you call home is breaking up with you. And as you said, I talk about it from the specific British context, just to make it honest and specific, but is very much an album I think Americans can relate to, the Indians can relate to, the people from the Philippines can relate to. A lot of people feel like their country is breaking up with them right now, a country that you helped build. And so to go with that album, we created this short film, The Long Goodbye, which is kind of an extended music video. And I'm proud to say we just won a couple of awards for it. The director is amazing, someone who I hope you interview in the future, Anil Karia. Up and coming, amazing South Asian director from London. And it's an example of like, you know, a piece of work that is me trying to just get things off my chest, work things out for myself, you know, build a home for myself in no man's land. And that's what my art is about. It's a cathartic experience for me. And it just so happens that my reality is one that is politicized because my existence is politicized.
Yeah.
Certain people, our existence here in these spaces is a controversial thing. So I just talk about that, and some people receive social and political, that's cool, whatever. But what drives me to make work is just that need to understand myself and the world a bit better.
Go ahead, Amanda.
I was gonna ask a question, but if you want to make a statement, go ahead.
Oh no, I was gonna say the beginning of the video, the extended video, I was telling Amanda, I was all, this is every single immigrant family, like getting ready for something. All the aunties are there, the girls are upstairs getting, you know, y'all are getting ready. I like connected with that so well. You were moving the furniture and they're like, oh, what are you doing? And like, you know, it's, there was something very home about it, but then it gets disrupted. And that's when, you know, kind of the story comes in. But I was just telling Amanda when I was watching it at first, I was like, oh, this is fun. You know, this is like me. Right. And then boom, something happened.
Right. Who are some of your influences, like your musical influences?
Mos Def was a huge influence on me. You know, I was actually just kind of discussing his album the other day and about how I returned to Black on Both Sides the other day. And And as I'm an older man now, I understand it better than when I did the first time around. These are timeless records. This is timeless material that defies genre, that defies a stereotype that people might place on him as a black man, as a Muslim, as a rapper, as a singer. Always kind of confounding expectations, switching it up. He's a chameleon whilst also always being himself. That's what I love. You know, I love it when the well that an artist can draw on is so deep and so wide that they could be pulling out totally different flavors the whole time, but it's still always somehow them. And I feel like that's a superpower that we have, those of us with complex identities, is I can always be me. I can talk like this and dress like this, and I'm me and I'm talking like this and dressing like this. You know, we have these different sides to us. I remember on his track, Love, I was just listening to it again. I realized, well, man, he's quoting bell hooks on this. You know, I only just went and read bell hooks like last year. I was listening to this as an 18-year-old, and now it's like, wow, I'm understanding it even more deeply. I think one line is it the pain of too much tenderness that makes me nod my head in reverence? Should I visit this place in remembrance or build landmarks here as evidence? We build it now for the promise of the infinite. You know, we build it now for the promise of the infinite. It's timeless stuff, you know. And anyway, he was a big influence on me musically. Another tradition that I've really drawn on again is the Afro-Caribbean sound system culture in London, which is a huge influence. You know, it's hard to overstate the impact of that culture in the UK, to the extent where, you know, people like me will grow up in a predominantly brown neighborhood, but all the slang I'll be speaking is Jamaican slang without even knowing it until I'm later on start leaving that neighborhood and have my eyes open to it. Similar to Toronto, maybe in that way, and so drum and bass music, in particular, this one band that if anyone's interested in checking out called Four Hero, the number four and then Hero. And what I loved about them is they're kind of continuing that tradition of almost Afrofuturism that bands like Sun Ra had, where they got like, yeah, we're making like rave music for the club and we're talking to aliens with this.
And we're, dope.
And we're from the future. I just love that, you know. I love this idea of, because so often our stories and our art is kind of seen in this almost kind of anthropological way, like, oh wow, it's like documentary realism, this kind of, but I love this idea of like liberating yourself through this imaginative leap, you know, this kind of Afrofuturist kind of leap of like, no, if my current conditions aren't ones of liberation, I'll imagine myself into a space, into outer space, an outer space of liberation, you know. And so Four Hero were a big impact on me as well.
Oh, dope. Wow. You're just dropping a lot of knowledge on us right now, so I'm trying to take it in. a lot of, you know, children of immigrants, people of color, queer people are often told, you know, when we're coming up, that not to rattle the cage, right? Keep your head down. Do the work, don't cause trouble no matter what. But I think we're slowly starting to see that change. Mm-hmm. But early on in your career, being a person of color, being an immigrant, were there moments where you felt like you had to bite your tongue so that you didn't disrupt anything? Or do you think you were, did you like follow a rebellious route? I think me and Amanda talk about this, how we, you know, there are times when we just don't say anything, or in our past, we don't say anything because it feels like we're not allowed to.
Man, we've all been there, and that's an act of survival. That's not something we should be ashamed of. That's a way of navigating, landscapes that are not of your own making and that you're not able to shape, you know. Things are changing now as there's more of us in that landscape. And we're also, you know, as I said, building our own homes out of what was previously no man's land. And that is a landscape we can shape. But we've all been in those rooms where we're the only one in the room. We've all been in those rooms where, someone said something and it's like, I'm going to pick my battles.
Yes.
It's an act of survival. Survival requires strategy. You know, no one should be ashamed of that. And I think sometimes we give each other too much of a hard time. Yeah. You know, ourselves, when people need to kind of pick their battles and strategize.
Yeah.
Why aren't you on, you know, level 10, like ready to kick down the door the whole time? It's like, because I'm going to break my foot if I'm kicking.
That's a good way to put it.
I need to walk on this foot as well. I need to stand on this foot. you know. So I think we've all been there, and I can think of a million little moments, but I think the thing that's most insidious and most consistent is the ways in which we don't realize we're editing ourselves. Mm-hmm. Is the way we might change even the way we talk, or might not fully represent our point of view on a topic in a room because we feel it might alienate us. Mm-hmm. Or make us stand out. That's the stuff that I've become more aware of as I've got older. Not the conscious, I'm biting my tongue, but like, my tongue's in between my teeth. I didn't even realize I put it there. Those moments where you kind of like go, okay, how can I stop editing myself right now? How can I bring all of me to this? And that's what, to be honest, you know, the work that I've been doing more recently has been very liberating in that sense, with the Long Goodbye short film. You know, it's so unapologetic. Many people were like, oh, you sure you want to do this? Like, and it's always the case that the stuff that's most unapologetically you is the stuff that connects the deepest with people. So in a way, what I'll say to anyone listening is, those moments when I have felt able to unbite my tongue has been the moments where my words have traveled the furthest.
Oh, dope. Yeah. And also, you made history, you know, as the first man of Asian descent to win an acting Emmy for The Night Of, which, you know, to this day, I think is one of the best limited series I've seen. Congratulations on that. I mean, I know it's been a while, but still, it still like rings so true. We are going through a lot of these firsts, right? Like, you know, first Black woman to do this, first disabled person to do this, and all that. But when you won that, for the Asian community, specifically the South Asian community, it was like a huge deal. But what were you thinking at the time? Because were you freaked out? Were you proud? Were you scared? Were you just like, I don't know what I'm doing up here? Having to now, I would see like it's like a default that you shoulder that, you know, like, we're looking to you now, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that burden of representation is also a tremendous gift in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's always double-edged, right? It's a tremendous privilege to know that the work that you do might carry a significance beyond just the work, you know, that it might kind of, you know, help certain people feel seen and heard that have not felt seen or heard otherwise, or help inspire them, or help just in its own incremental tiny way towards stretching culture, towards stretching our collective consciousness. That's a tremendous privilege, man. A lot of people don't have that, you know, cross the bear. But also it can be paralyzing because you find yourself second guessing what if you're doing right by those people and what those people might need. And you know, it's a kind of shift that I've kind of made as well recently, where I've thought less about like representing and more about presenting myself, you know, and realizing that actually it's impossible for me to represent others if I, as an artist, cannot fully just present myself. And the first step towards that kind of freedom is actually to look within rather than kind of crowdsource, you know, from what you think your people might require of you. And it took me a minute, you know, and I think there's been that shift in my music and a shift in my work as well. You know, I've got this film that I just made called Mogul Mowgli, which won't be out in the US till next year, but it's a very personal piece. And, you know, for a long time, I was thinking about how to do a big story, a grand canvas about the British Asian experience. And I ended up kind of honing back in on, let me just tell some of my story, man. And actually, let me trust that the specificity and honesty of that will resonate. And so, I don't know, I think it kind of works in stages, because I think when you put in that kind of position of like, you're the only one in the room, you're the only one in the newsroom, you're the only one in whatever it is, whatever field you're in, you start off kind of thinking, well, how am I representing us to people who are not us? That's the first level. And you're like, oh, I don't want them to think with this or that, or I've got to speak up with it. Then you kind of get past that and go to, how am I doing by my own people, by us? Like, am I giving them what they need? And then I think a helpful bridge for me was thinking more just, what would I make for my own 18-year-old self? You know, bring it back to something more personal. And now I'm grateful to say I'm in a place where I'm more just like following my creative curiosity, because I think that knowing that, you know, you might have a large community's eyes or hopes on you it's an amazing jet fuel, you know, but it's not a good GPS.
Mm.
You know, oh, I think it's yeah. a good jet. I
yeah.
think
yeah.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
Force, you know, when you lose confidence in yourself, it's good to believe in something bigger than and other than yourself. Yeah. So it can give you that. But in terms of which direction should I go, you've got to follow your curiosity as an artist, I think.
Well
yeah.
put.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, going off of what you were saying, you know, going off of that, you know, within the Asian community, I'm Filipino myself, and, you know, we are seeing a lot of representation on the Asian and the Asian American front. But oftentimes within communities, maybe not even just the Asian community, but also Latinx, even the Black community, you know, there's silos, right? When it comes to Asian narratives, we are often, people automatically go to East Asian, which is fine. You know, I love my East Asian brothers and sisters. South Asian, Southeast Asians tend to be left out of the conversation more often than not. They don't think of us as Asians. And, you know, we are put into these silos. And I think oftentimes colorism plays, I think, a part of that. Like within your experience and, you know, from the beginning to now, and even just talking with your own Asian peers, South Asian peers and people in, I guess, in London and in America, how do you see that changing? Do you think it's a problem? You know, I'll be honest, I think our community is fractured, but no one really wants to say anything. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's... It reminds me of that thing where like people love going to Indian restaurants in London and in the UK, right? It's our national dish is curry.
Yeah.
Also, those restaurants aren't Indian, bro. They're not Indian restaurants. They've had to brand themselves as Indian restaurants to get people through the door. They're Bangladeshi or they're Pakistani, you know, like 90% of those Indian restaurants in the UK, basically. And it just reminds me of that interesting thing of like, you know, how to sometimes to kind of get things going, we need to use these quite broad labels. And then once we're in there, we can kind of start getting more specific and granular about stuff. And it reminds me of that a little bit when we're seeing, you know, I guess, I mean, even just the term Asian is a nonsensical. So you're talking about a label that takes in the Russian Caucasus, you know, the Middle East, you know, Sri Lanka, you know what I mean? Thailand, China, like what?
Singapore, Malaysia. Like, there's so much.
These labels mean nothing, right? And ultimately, I think the stronger stories are the ones that lean into the hyper specificity of the character's experience. And when they do that, the reason we relate to them isn't because I didn't relate to the farewell because you know, I'm Chinese. I relate to it because of its honesty,
right?
Because of its specificity. When I'm listening to Kendrick Lamar talk about Compton, I don't relate to it because I grew up in Compton. I relate to the honesty within it. And so, yeah, I think the way we need to go is to embrace the kind of micro specificity of all these different experiences. Now, do I think that there's a way to go? Yes. This is an endless kind of journey, yeah, right? To stretch culture to its like, and just to continue to stretch it till we can all see ourselves in it. But I do think that it's a win for me as a British Pakistani Muslim when you have you know, John Boyega cast in Star Wars, you know, and it's a win for you as a Filipino man, you know what I mean? If you know, I get cast in it, or is it,
yeah,
you know,
it has to.
We have to look at it that way because otherwise, and I think this is a issue sometimes on woke Twitter and you know, identity politics on steroids, is this idea of like, of just we're just dividing ourselves. We're doing the job for them. You know what I mean? Like dominant culture is presents itself as a monolith, and those of us who are trying to break that down. You know, we do have a united struggle. We do need to root for each other.
Yeah.
You know, as much as we need to be cognizant of our differences and fight for different specific experiences coming to the fore, I have to believe and I want to believe that it's a win for all of us when we stretch culture one way or another. It's a tricky thing because yes, solidarity, but also let's not lose the specificity of our differences.
Yeah.
It's always a tricky balance.
It is.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Sound of Metal. So the movie's coming out, will be out in December, this weekend, actually. So you play Ruben, who is a drummer who is starts experiencing drastic hearing loss. And it was so uniquely done, because I felt like I was you. Like, I felt like I was experiencing what your character was experiencing, the way the sound techniques that Darius, the director, used, even with the way we saw the subtitles. I noticed in the beginning there weren't any subtitles, and I assumed that because you were so new to this community, your character was so new to this community that, you know, obviously you didn't know the language at that point. And I just thought it was so interesting to really, it really took us through the experience. Your character's experience. So I want to ask you, so what attracted you to this project?
You know, I didn't realize just how much of a first-person movie it would be, which is what you're describing, right? The way it's shot is so intimate, is often shot in close-up. It's got this observational documentary feel. We shot it chronologically. We only had one or two takes on the scene. So we were really living through it in sequence. But the sound design is kind of a unique endeavor. Right. They've basically, you know, normally when you shoot a scene, the sound recorders will come on set and say, let's do a wild track, which means repeat all the dialogue just without filming, you know, on camera, just repeat on audio the dialogue in case there was a bus driving past and you get all the lines clean. On this film, after every scene, the sound designer, Nicola Becker, who did Gravity, would be on set and he'd place this kind of crazy contraption, this like hexagon from space, it looked like, and he'd put it against my chest and he'd say, blink. And you say, lick your lips. Inhale, hold your breath so I can hear your heartbeat. Exhale, now swallow. The entire audio landscape of Sound of Metal was made up from my internal bodily processes.
Wow.
And the reason for that is when you lose your external hearing, you maintain a lot of your bodily vibrational hearing and your internal processes go up in the sound mix of your brain. And so Darius has done a lot of really bold things to put right there in the driver's seat with Ruben. But I didn't know any of that when I was taking the role on. The thing that attracted me to it was three things. First, the script was amazing. And then I realized, oh yeah, this is the guy who wrote on Blue Valentine and Place Beyond the Pines. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's going to be amazing. Then it was Darius himself, just an absolute king, just like the sweetest, most inspirational leader, just lead by example as a risk taker, you know, and he's just going to be such a tremendous voice in cinema. This is his first film.
Right.
And the third thing that really got me going kind of perversely was he just threw down a challenge in our first meeting, said, you know, whoever's going to play this role, they'd have to learn the drums.
Yeah.
They'd have to learn sign language for real, because I don't want to fake anything. I want it to be a real gig in a real club with a real audience. And I was just looking, I kind of look for things that would overwhelm me and throw me off balance, because then I can't, when I'm not in control, I think that's when interesting things happen. And so I said, let's do it. And that challenge of learning the drums, learning sign language every day for 7 months was one of the scariest things I've done, one of the hardest things I've done, but it was also one of the most tremendous privileges of my career to be welcomed into deaf culture and to learn American Sign Language. And so, you know, it turned out that the challenges often end up being the gifts, you know, and that's what my character Ruben discovers.
Yeah. How long did it take you to pick up the drumming and the sign language?
Well, I was just, you know, they're lifelong things. I could keep doing them forever. You don't get to an end point, but I had 7 months.
Okay.
Every day for 7 months. My drum teacher, Guy Licata, and my sign instructor and friend, Jeremy Stone. So it was just like, you know, a few hours with them every day. It was just like a full-time thing. It was like 9 to 5 and drumming and signing, drumming and signing. And I got to say, man, that like, I don't know, have you ever had any experience of signing or anything? Or
I learned a little bit,
me too. School,
they made us learn the letters, but I've never, I didn't really pick up.
And we recently had Niall DeMarco on,
who
on our podcast, and it was our first deaf guest, and we had like a whole video, and it was very deaf-friendly, or tried to make it as deaf-friendly as possible. And we learned a lot just talking to someone from the
Even watching his reality show, he has a reality show called Deaf You on Netflix, and just watching that, I learned so much about deaf. Like I didn't even know. Like I know your character goes through. I don't know if I should spoil it, but there's
that's fine.
There's an argument. There's sort of a point about deaf culture. Yeah, exactly. Mm. So it was very interesting. I didn't, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say is that when I was asking you guys just now is like, I've just learned so much.
Yeah.
And I've learned above all that for many deaf people, deafness is not a disability.
Yeah.
It's a culture. And it's
rich
and diverse, and it's a way of being. And some people believe in cochlear implants and some people don't. Some people get them and then regret it. And some people get them and it changes their life. And for many people, deafness is not a thing to be fixed, you know, and that's a very ableist kind of perspective, actually, this idea of like looking to fix something, always looking to get a fix.
Yeah.
And it ties in really with Ruben's history of addiction as a character.
Yeah.
He's always trying to get a fix. It's the addictive personality that he has and that we have as a society, really, of, you know, instant gratification, trying to get a fix, trying to fix things as opposed to accepting things. And looking for the gift in them.
And
I think that's a lot of what this movie's about, really. It's about kind of how we deal with change, mm-hmm. and whether and really asking a big question. I know, you know, this podcast, a lot of it's about identity, is what is our identity really? You know, if I thought deafness was a disability and I realized it's not, it's a culture, then that's an identity.
Right.
But then if deafness is something that you might gain as an identity later in life, then what is your fundamental identity? You know, like over the course of the film, Ruben goes from being a punk drummer in a relationship who lives in an RV to like living in a deaf sober house in the woods, speaking ASL and like not being in a relationship. And he's the same guy.
Yeah.
It kind of means that a lot of the labels that we think define us are, that's not, you know, that's not who we really are deep down, you know? And I think that's interesting as a story to tell in these times.
I played set for a minute. Like I played drum set for like, cause I was in drumline and I was just like, I'm gonna learn to play set. Coordinating my, you know, the one and two and then like the bass, it took a lot out of me. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm fine without doing this. But how was it like entering, you know, drum, playing set? And do you have experience playing set
before? No, I didn't have any drumming experience, which is why it was an intense process, you know. But it was kind of crazy because I feel like both the drums and American Sign Language is both nonverbal communication, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm someone who plays a lot with words as a rapper and spoken word artist. So having that crutch taken from me, it forced me to be in my body in a different way, you know? Mm. And they both kind of shaped the performance, but shaped me as a person. You know, my drum teacher would tell me, stop thinking. You can't think your way to playing this. Your mind won't be as quick as your body. You got to surrender to the rhythm of it and you got to let it play you, which is just like acting, really.
Yeah.
You know, you go in with your plans, you try and control it, it's going to come off dead. You got to let the scene tell you who you are. You don't tell the scene what it is, you know? And similarly with ASL, I kind of feel like it just changed me so much because it was like, you know, Jeremy, my sign instructor, told me there's a saying in the deaf community that hearing people are emotionally repressed. And the reason for that is because we hide behind words.
Oh,
words as a mask.
Yes.
Whereas, and I was like, okay, that's interesting. And then when I started becoming more fluent in ASL, I found myself getting really emotional talking about certain things in a way I wouldn't if I was just speaking.
Mm.
And that's because you are inhabiting your body and communicating with your whole body in a totally different way, you know. And so I guess what I'm getting at is, as much as yes, it was a challenge, I didn't have experience in either of them, and it was a tremendous gift, you know, at the end of this process of connecting me more to myself and my body as an actor and as a human. And I hope that if people hear about my preparation process for this, rather than think about like, oh, that must have been really difficult, they think, man, that's cool. I'm going to learn American Sign Language. Yeah. You know? There's an amazing gift at the end of that.
Right.
So did you buy a set? I'm guessing you're going to continue. No, you going to
continue? I stole Darius's son's drum kit, man.
Oh. do you still practice?
No, I don't practice the drums. My neighbors will thank me.
That's the thing
as an actor, you learn these, you step into a life, you learn these skills, and then just when you think, I'm going to keep that up, boom, you've got to change gear and go into the next
thing. But so, I'm sure, I think being so immersed in like cult, in the music world, like I remember things that I played in high school in drumline. Like if a drum was put in front of me, I could probably play it still. It's kind of like embedded in
like
me.
A muscle. Yeah.
It's like a muscle. It's like, I mean, I'm sure like further down the road, it's like, oh, hey Riz, play the drums at a party. You'll be all, no, and then you'll just like break it down.
Like, how did I do that? It'll be like an expert. Like, how do I have these powers?
Yeah. Right.
So like you've had a very diverse resume of movies, you know, from Nightcrawler to The Night Of, you were in Girls, Rogue One, which is honestly one of my favorite Star Wars movies, and then Venom, and then now Sound of Metal. It's like you pivot so much to like these very interesting roles. When you are choosing projects, or when you're just like people come to you, or if you're just like looking for something to do, do you have like a rubric? Do you have an agenda? That sound makes it, making it sound very, you know, hardcore, but like how do you go about choosing your projects and like stepping into them?
Yeah, what interests you?
Yeah, I guess, you know, you have to end up developing a rubric. Even if it's not explicit, it kind of is somewhere there in the back of your mind. And for me, the mantra has been, does it stretch me and does it stretch culture? Mm. You know, am I scared by this? Am I going to grow new muscles from doing this? Okay, then that's cool. And does it stretch culture? And stretching culture doesn't necessarily mean it has to be like standing on a soapbox, waving a fist, telling you about like, you know, the alternate history of you know, whatever. It's actually just me and a rom-com can stretch culture, actually.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like just something that's shot in a really dope way can stretch culture. Something that brings more of the deaf community on screen in an authentic way and allows them to represent themselves, you know, can stretch culture. And so I kind of think a lot about just that, like, and usually the thing I find is the two things overlap.
Yeah.
Now, if it's something that we haven't seen before, it's probably something I haven't done before, you know? And so the two things tend to overlap. And the other thing I find is that both those things will also often lead to something that can be quite engaging for audiences, you know?
Yeah.
Audiences want to see stuff they haven't seen before. They want to, you know, seeing performers go to new places. So that's the kind of thing I try and think about more than what do people want?
Yeah.
Or what might be a good move, you know?
Right.
Makes sense.
Is there a role or a genre that you haven't tackled yet that you are wanting to?
You know, I don't know if I want to tackle this, but it occurred to me the other day that there's two things I haven't done. And just for that reason, I should probably try and explore them. One of them is horror.
Oh, dope.
I can't imagine how like intense it must be to be in horror. Like to constantly be in that place. Like that must be the most stressful shit ever. So that's one thing that I'm interested in kind of, actually, I don't even know if I'm interested in doing it, but I know I haven't gone to that place.
Yeah.
Although, you know what? That's just a lie, because Mogul Mowgli has kind of horror. I was going to say, I haven't done a horror and I haven't done a musical. And actually, someone described Mogul Mowgli to me the other day as a Sufi horror musical.
Oh shoot!
And I was okay, like, well, I'm sold.
I was like, I guess there are musical elements and horror elements in it. Oh, nice. But no, I guess I one thing I'd like to get back to a bit more is comedy. You know, I really enjoyed doing some comedy earlier on in my career, and enjoyed doing Girls, and you know, I was really grateful to do Four Lions with Jesse Armstrong, who wrote Succession many years ago. And I'd like to kind of get back to doing some comedy, just because A, is so much fun, but B, it really is a very technical skill.
Right.
You know, it's about timing and about having the discipline to do nothing. I find it kind of keeps you sharp doing comedy.
Yeah, I always say comedy looks like it's a lot harder to do than drama.
Yeah,
it takes a different discipline, I think. Yeah. It takes a different kind of speed and a different kind of technical thing, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas I think with drama, which is different, I guess, I don't know if it's more difficult, but it's difficult in another way in that you got to go to the place emotionally. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like it's like sushi versus like casserole. You know, one is about soaking in the juices for ages, and the other one's like precision and getting the exact balance.
Yeah. Comedy is just like, it fascinates me, and like how funny people could be. And I took one improv class before, and I'm like, oh, I do not know how these like brilliant people think on their feet like that and are so witty and snappy with their comebacks. I'm here like all I don't know.
Admired comedians, like that's one thing that I'm like, I wish I had a funny bone. I think that'll definitely come in handy in life. So Riz, before we wrap up, this has been a great conversation, by the way. So, but before we wrap up, we like to end with this segment we call the facts or the FAQs. Just random fun questions. no pressure. So for the first question, if you can choose another instrument to learn, what would it be?
It would probably be piano.
Yeah.
Because it's great sounding for everything. And then, I'd like to be able to produce my own beat.
Nice. Have you picked up any new hobbies during the past 9 months of all of what's been going on?
Yeah, I've been growing plants, you know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've been wanting to start doing that, growing a garden.
Very therapeutic, I think, and just a little bit of joy every day, just keeping something alive. And so plants.
Yeah, I just bought my first plant.
I am horrible at taking care of plants, even with succulents.
I believe in you.
Okay.
I managed to kill succulents one day. I had no idea I could do that.
Okay. If we asked your friends and family, what is Riz's worst habit? What would they say?
Worst habit? Oh my God. Probably that I just do too much. I need to just chill. Maybe get more rest.
Yeah.
Maybe just slow down a little bit. That's what they probably say.
Okay. Here's a hypothetical. Let's say tomorrow a huge studio comes to you and says, "We are giving you an unlimited budget to direct and star in a biopic of anyone you want. Who would it be?"
Woo. Anyone I want. Wow. So, but it would be someone I have to be able to play.
Mm-hmm. Direct and star and produce. Why not?
You know, interestingly, I think that this is just what's kind of popping into my head at this moment right now. But I think the history of the moguls is a really interesting history. It's one I become increasingly interested in as someone from South Asia, because the Mughal Empire was a quarter of all the world's wealth before the British went to India. And this was a multicultural empire, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, you know, one of the most richest and technologically advanced in the world. It's like we're talking about, you know, 1300s, 1500s. And I guess maybe Babur you know, who kind of founded that Mughal dynasty,
yeah,
or Akbar, who was at the peak of that dynasty. That could be a really interesting story to tell, man.
You get, yeah.
Wear lots of amazing costumes, build the Taj Mahal, all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, I'm gonna switch it up from a question. What are your top three albums?
Yes.
Ooh, top three albums. That's hard. Okay, Mos Def, Black on Both Sides. You know, we already touched on that. Four Hero, Creating Patterns. We already touched on that. And the third one, maybe. God, let me think. This is so hard. This is such a mean question.
Only three.
Only three. I could have given you five.
I'm gonna go with Michael Jackson's Bad.
Mm.
You know,
that's a good one.
Just grew up on it, and it was just kind of defined my kind of childhood in a way. You know, it's just got amazing tracks on it.
Yeah. Watershed album.
Wait, what about you, Amanda? What's your? Do you have a top one?
I Whitney Houston. I can't think of the Bodyguard album was. The soundtrack is amazing. I like soundtracks. Waiting to Exhale soundtrack was amazing. Mm. I'm trying to think. Drake. And honestly, I'm a huge Drake fan. I would say I can't even choose which one is my favorite album. I honestly always like all his stuff. But so I would just say top three is Drake.
Because all of his stuff. of That's your
Drake,
choice.
Drake and Whitney Houston.
If Drake ever releases a greatest hits, how many CDs would that be?
It would be a lot. I was in Drake has singles after singles after singles. I'm like, what?
It would be a box set. A box set of greatest hits. That's what it would be. Yeah. Mine is like, I think it, like I recently did, you know how Spotify does the whole, you listen for you the year, like the wrap up. Mine continues and continuously is Lauryn Miseducation Hill. Of Lauryn Hill. It always is. And I'm like,
good album. I should have chosen that. That's such a good album.
Cool time. Well, we'll let you have that one too, Riz. We'll put that on your list. So our last question is, you kind of answered this already, but feel free to add more.
Right.
Is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, creator, that is not in the mainstream? You think people need to know and deserves more shine from the industry?
Wow. I mean, I think there's just an amazing crop of new talent kind of coming through, South Asian talent that I'm aware of, and I'm lucky to have collaborated with a little bit. And one of them is the director of my short film, you know, Anil Kharia. His debut feature, Surge, to Sundance Shear, and won the Best Actor Award for the incredible Ben Whittle. And it's a really, really I think it's just a matter of time before people know his name. And similarly, I think Bassam Tariq, who directed Mogul Mowgli and who co-wrote it with me, such a distinctive voice, and something he always thinks about isn't just like, how do we make this good? But like, how do we contribute to the language of cinema? How do we bring in Asian, South Asian, Islamic art influences, mythology into the way we tell stories on film. So he's someone who's always trying to almost grow the medium of film by bringing our heritage to the table. So I think Bassam and Anil are two people that ones to watch for sure.
Shout out to them. And thank you again, Riz, for being here.
Yes, Riz.
Amazing. This Sound of Metal is
a great conversation for real.
Right. Amazon on the 4th. Everybody should watch it. It is very touching. It is informative. You definitely learn something new, which is what I love when I experience films. So congrats and thanks again.
Thank you, Riz.
Thanks so much, guys.